Minister, perhaps I could...
I gave you a list of questions, Catherine, where are they?
Yes, I guess the question from the Australian community's point of view is just how you balance the decision-making around purchases that take such a long time to come about in an environment where the requirements of the ADF are, need to be immediate in response to very uncertain circumstances. I guess I'm alluding to what must be the major challenge of your job, but it would be very interesting to get your insights into that tension that exists between the decisions to respond internationally particularly, or indeed locally, and how you actually properly anticipate the needs for equipment and platforms.
Well, I think there's a number of things. Which the first thing we need to appreciate is that what's going to shape our future is not what we currently know, but that which we don't. And it was interesting, in Washington recently, I had a meeting with people who drive the intellectual debate in America in relation to defence at the American Enterprise Institute. So they brought a group of people in to have a chat about things, and they were discussing our region, and in particular the interest, if not concern, Americans have in Chinese military build-up. And I said to them, and they were a little surprised that Australia seemed relatively sanguine about it, and which we're not. And but I said to them that in thinking about the future and the defence and protection of our values and our interests, not just domestically but in the region and globally, the Chinese rate of investment in R&D and production of PhD students and the significant reforms in its, the top end of its higher education sector, in fact, are arguably of more concern in a strategic sense in terms of us competing than many other things. The third thing is that our defence organisation, whatever the popular culture for criticising it in various ways, is operationally extremely busy at the moment. Yes, it is. We have 9 different deployments running at the moment, including border protection in the top end of the country. But it is very, very capable of discharging its responsibilities and doing so as well, if not better, than any defence force of its size in the world, at the same time as being able to think in the long term strategically about where we're going to go. The Defence Capability Plan, which I released at the Defence and Industry Conference, takes us out in a broad sense till 2016 in terms of money and broad capability, but it is a minimalist position. And I repeat, and the Prime Minister, you'll notice a couple of days ago, said that he thinks that we might have to spend more on defence above and beyond the 3% real compounding out to 2016. So thinking about and how we adapt to, plan for and cope with the uncertain environment, it is difficult, but we, as I can only, from our government's perspective, we've made a conscious decision that notwithstanding the economic issues that we face in the next decade, that we are going to invest more, a lot more in defence, that we are going to deliver on the DCP, notwithstanding the caveats that are put on that, and that we also anticipate that we might have to do other things for which we have not planned, and we're capable of doing it. And the other thing that's very important is our alliances in that regard. Mm. It's fashionable in some parts of Australia to be critical of Australia's alliance with the United States and perhaps the United Kingdom, but it is also about capability and capability planning in our region, and the United States sees us as being an important part of that as well.
David Walker from CEDA, Minister. One of the things we heard while we were going through the process of building the report, and heard fairly consistently, is the difficulty that a lot of industry members have with defence's status, in many cases as the sole buyer within Australia of what they're planning to or looking at building. And that's always going to be a tension for defence. But how do you get around that? How do you address that on a regular basis at the moment?
Well, it's one of the, Paul Dibb, who's sitting right in front of me, Paul's paper again reinforces Paul's view that defence is the monopoly purchaser other than foreign sales. And foreign sales, of course, by the way, is one of the objectives of the defence industry review. I am, as in all things, I try to put myself in your shoes. You know, I try to think, well, if I was running one of the primes or an SME in Australia and trying to get business from defence and have some certainty, what would be my issues and concerns? And I think one of the problems that I think you have, those of you in industry that is that there is an opaque part of the decision-making process which is not clearly defined, which brings an enormous amount of uncertainty to you. You've got a lot of certainty now in terms of money and the broad capability that we believe we're going to be engaged in, including sustainment over the next decade and beyond. But there are political judgments that are being made. And what I'm trying to do is to see that we put some flags in the ground within which we know we're all basically going to swim. And that's what it's about. And it's also about, you know, Ron Fisher from Raytheon said to me in one of his early meetings with me, having told me we don't need a defence industry policy, I mean, if I was in the electronics sector, I'd probably have that view too. But having said we didn't need one, then Ron went on to say, he said, but one of the things we've got to deal with is a much better relationship between the SMEs and the primes, and also getting SMEs in the global supply chain. And I said, it sounds like you're thinking about defence industry policy, Ron. So how will we be able to deal with it? And I think the reality is that the government will continue to be the major purchaser. I think Steve Gumley and David supporting him in capability have brought a lot of market tension into it in Kinnaird. But the end result is I am aware of the fact that we, as I said in my remarks, we make decisions that have significant impacts on companies, employees and entire regions of the country, and that's what we're endeavouring to do in this defence industry policy. One of the things is to give a degree of certainty to you in that regard. I can't say any more than that at the moment.
Minister, good morning. Vice Admiral Rob Walls, retired. No affiliations. I haven't had a chance to read the CETA papers yet, but a quick look through the index indicates to me that manpower required to sustain capability is not a principal item in terms of paper or chapter headings. I also would make an observation that a quick examination of the index indicates to me that there are perhaps some other parties that we've yet to hear from in this debate that contributes to your review. And here, for example, I might cite the DMO or Defence itself. My concern or my question to you is about the skilled workforce that we need to sustain the capabilities of the Defence Force, what the size of it is, the existing state of it, if you like, what the future of it is, and what our plans and intentions are as a nation or those concerned with matters of defence and national security to develop and sustain the skilled workforce. I think it's fair to say that across the nation there are many people in many industries who are addressing the need for this broadly based, broadly skilled workforce. There seems to be a shortage. After all, there's some visa programs running to bring some skilled workers in. If we're to develop our shipbuilding capabilities to address the construction of air warfare destroyers and amphibious ships, and then to look at the support programs that will be required through the life of not only ships, but the equipment of the Army, the aircraft of the Air Force, through their 20, 25, 40-year life cycles, then clearly something must be done to improve the nature and the ways in which we're going about skilling our workforce. So my question to you is, what expectations do you have from the review that's being conducted in recommendations for developing methods to train and skill the workforce that we'll need to sustain these defence capabilities for us?
Well, thank you very much. I mean, that's the real problem that we face, not just in the defence, but right across our country. And, you know, we've put a lot of effort and money into capability, but in the end it's the people who really count. And skills is one of the seven priorities that I've defined in the discussion paper in Defence Industry Consultation. And one of the things that, as I say, I want to have is much more strategic planning, which is a partnership between industry and the DMO, which a significant part of which is skills. The problem for us is that over the next 40 years, our age dependency ratios will drop from 5.3 to 2.6 to 1, and that is a major challenge for us. And in terms of skills, I go back to my previous portfolio. I think firstly there has to be an expectation in our society that every person will be cared for but will make a contribution to this society in one shape or form, and the welfare to work reforms at the moment are a part of that. The second is we should live in a country where people feel that they are able to, young people in particular, can do the things to which in their own hearts they feel they're best suited and not pursue the things that are projected onto them by their parents with their unfulfilled ambitions and the aspirations of teachers, which too often seem to be narrow cast. The third thing is that we need a training environment in Australia which has generic skills which are transferable from one industry to another. The car industry is very important in motor vehicle building, is very important in South Australia, for example. And from time to time there are issues about, particularly surrounding one of those manufacturers, about its long-term and its future. The nature of training by industry, not just in defence industry, but right across the sector, ought to be about ensuring that employees are as transferable as they possibly can be, which means that rationalising training programs, modules for training and a whole variety of things. The other thing that's important is, and the air warfare destroyers and the LHDs are good examples of, in my view, nation-building projects, but the decisions that we make on each of those projects will have a bearing on the other, particularly in relation to skills. And for that reason, I think that we need to make those decisions concurrently, and there needs to be significant consultation with industry in the process. I think we also need to be prepared as a nation. There's a lot of part of what's colouring the political debate at the moment is you'll notice the opposition is castigating the government for having skilled migrants coming to Australia, at least in certain areas. And I think there needs to be a more mature debate than that, that we need to be prepared to accept that if we want Indigenous build, we're going to have to do everything we can to see Australians are actively involved in that, but in a number of areas that we are going to have to responsibly have people from other countries who have particular skills we don't have to come here and help us. So this is going to be a real challenge for us, which is not the solution for which is not confined only to defence and defence industry. I won't then not say any more.
Another issue that extends beyond the defence industry is Australian business connecting to global markets and our potential to increase export. Do you see that as being a genuine opportunity in defence industries, if it's properly geared and orientated?
Oh, there's no question, Catherine, that I think the DMO at the moment, and Jim Mullen in particular, has a good unit there that is doing, I think, is doing a good job to assist Australian industry in export. But apart from the government, which Paul in front of me would argue is a monopsony purchaser in this area, export is the other way of sustaining capability. And I think in terms of thinking strategically about Indigenous capability and the... in fact, over the next decade, it's not likely we're going to have a lot of troughs, but in those relatively quieter times, I think one of the things that we'll certainly be focusing on and working with industry on is what sectors of Australian defence industry in particular is it especially important that we give them assistance in getting into international markets and global supply chains and focusing on them, because any effort that we can assist industry, large or small, to sell to other countries means that there's less pressure on, you know, the Australian taxpayer to basically support the industries we think are essential to strategic capability in times where we may not have much work coming their way from the Australian government.
Is there a final question from the floor?
Andrew Fletcher from the Port Adelaide Maritime Corporation, Minister. One of the other tensions that is coming through in as we evolve this defence sustainability and defence industry debate is the tension between the commitments of various states and the competitive approach from states to the defence industry support regime. Our own state in South Australia is committing over $300 million in terms of workforce growth, workforce skills development and support infrastructure to the Air Warfare Destroyer program. Do you see a situation where we will evolve to a point where there is a sustainability and predictability from a state point of view on which areas of defence different states will support, or do you think this will just stay as an outcome of marketplace competition?
Well, thanks, Andrew. Well, philosophically, you know, we're a liberal party, and so philosophically our views are based on idealism, hard work, self-sacrifice, and basically within reason allowing some competitive market tension to sort things out. And I know some of you are sitting there thinking, yeah, well, I can think of a lot of areas where that may not be the case, but we would hesitate, our government at least, would hesitate to be too prescriptive in that regard. The state governments, to varying degrees, are, at the moment, mainly the major investors in infrastructure and defence industry. And the 12 companies that are currently getting 60% of our business are all wonderful companies. But I think one of reflecting the kind of absence of clear direction in defence industry policy over the last decade or so, they have been, for reasons I appreciate if I was in their shoes or a shareholder, have been reluctant to invest in any significant way in infrastructure, and the state governments have done that. The South Australian government in particular, I must say, has been very, very good, notwithstanding the political differences between us. It is a matter, I think, for us, the DMO, the Australian government, to work with industry in planning strategically. And I, you know, in a partnership, I know that sounds an odd thing to say, but in a partnership, thinking about, well, what are we going to need, not just over the next decade, but the next 30 years, and having some sense of agreement and what are we going to need in capability, and then industry and the state governments themselves determining what's the best infrastructure to, and where should it be. It's I'd be hesitant for the to have the Commonwealth, you know, basically building, in a sense, where things should be built and what should be built and so on and so forth. I don't think we would want to see it. We certainly wouldn't want to see it that regulated. But I'd also say that you know, I mentioned that I'd been asked about whether the location would be important in deciding the LHD contract. Well, you know as well as I do, there are a lot of things that will be taken into account. But one thing that is important to Australians is the money that we are responsible for is not the government's money, it's the money of everyday Australians, people who work damn hard for it. And apart from some fringe dwellers, they are quite happy to see it invested in defence and more of it invested in defence. But they also expect us to get value for that money. And within reason, Australians, a lot of the people who support Chris's remarks on national service, are equally, if not more enthusiastic about seeing Australian money, their money, invested in Australia with Australian-based companies or perhaps Australian companies themselves. So one of the things that we do take into account, and we've said there will be Australian build on the LHDs, it's a question of what proportion, particularly in a very tight labour market when we're building three AWDs. But we've said that because it is important that we get some economic and social amplifiers, and The state governments have been, not all of them, New South Wales government has been particularly poor in this regard, but the South Australian government has been particularly good in recognising an opportunity and a responsibility and putting some of its money into working with industry to get some infrastructure up. So that's a long answer to a short question, but basically we would be very hesitant to be too prescriptive in that regard. Innovative solutions coming from industry and state government working collaboratively with our DMO, that is much more preferable.